Thanks. So today I'm presenting on a multi-year effort organized by the Williams Institute to research best practices for asking survey questions about gender identity, transgender status, and gender expression, or as we call them, gender-related measures or gender-related questions. I have no relationships to disclose. So this multi-year effort organized by Williams has been called the Genius Group, because we're all incredibly smart. But in reality, it stands for Gender Identity and U.S. Surveillance. And the group is a national collaboration of scientists and scholars and leaders of trans-focused organizations throughout the country. The group and its work were modeled after the SMART group, which stands for Sexual Minority Research Assessment Team. And I guess we had to one-up them on the name, apparently. So SMART developed a best practices guide for collecting sexual orientation through surveys. And that guide has been very helpful in efforts to add questions related to sexual orientation to surveys such as the National Health Interview Survey that just started collecting that data. And so the mission of the Genius Group is to increase and better understand population-based data about transgender people through the inclusion of gender-related measures on population-based surveys with particular consideration for publicly funded data collection efforts. And to accomplish its mission, Genius will conduct rigorous research, scientific research on gender-related measures, and make policy recommendations regarding measurement research and data collection. So to fulfill our mission, we had our first meeting back in June of 2011 and met again in May of 2013. And some activities between the two meetings and subsequent to the last one have included drafting a letter to U.S. Health and Human Services to encourage them to engage in survey question testing. We drafted a document that outlines current practices in gender-related measures on surveys, so what's just what people are currently doing. We funded two research projects, one of which was led by Sari Reisner, to complete cognitive testing of gender-related measures, and both studies have been completed. And based on those findings and further research, we're in the process of drafting a best practices document, which we hope will not only be helpful but persuasive in getting gender identity expression and transgender status questions added to surveys. So today I'm going to give an overview of this best practices document that is, we're still currently working on it, so things may change. But we're recommending some measures for use and some for additional testing. And a variety of measures are provided in order to provide options for a variety of different types of survey designs. And I'll spend the majority of my time discussing the measures themselves, but we'll point to other issues covered in the report. So first, it's important to figure out why we're bothering with all of this work. Why collect data on trans status, gender identity, and gender expression? Well, I really could just cite all the previous presentations. Obviously, there are some disparities in health and health outcomes. But there just really is much that we don't know about transgender people's experiences and health, especially on a national scale. So the IOM reports, the health of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people said, and I quote, we need to advance understanding of the health needs of all LGBT individuals. Researchers need more data about the demographics of these populations, improved methods for collecting and analyzing data, and an increased participation of sexual and gender minorities in research. And according to the 2011 National Healthcare Disparities Report, transgender people are disproportionately likely to experience violence in the home, on the street, and in healthcare settings. And, of course, we've already talked about the NCDS, but it has it found that trans people have experienced discrimination in healthcare settings, have poor health outcomes, are four times as likely as the general population to be living in extreme poverty, defined as an annual income under $10,000, and more likely to not have health insurance coverage, though health insurance is currently changing. So having data from national population-based surveys would go a long way to creating a better understanding, creating better interventions, better programs, and better policy for trans people in the U.S. So some example target surveys that we would really like to have gender identity or gender-related measures included on include the National Health Interview Survey. That's the top priority because it's the primary source of information on the health of the civilian non-institutionalized population in the United States. These other surveys are also important not only for health but for understanding population characteristics and experiences of victimization and the economic circumstances of the trans population. So what to ask? This is the kind of the heart of this project. But a few things to consider first. Questions must not confuse non-transgender individuals, so or cisgender individuals. So Sari and I tend to joke that this project really is should be titled the How Not to Confuse Cisgender People Project. because the trans population is so small, of course, that less than 1%, according to current estimates, that even a small percentage of cisgender people who would incorrectly select themselves into a trans category could flood that category and make it less meaningful or not meaningful at all. So we really need to not confuse those folks. questions also need to correctly identify trans people. So as much as we don't want cisgender people to be incorrectly categorized as trans, we want trans people to correctly identify themselves in surveys, which there are some problematic statements there, but we're working through that. Finally, population surveys may not allow for deep detailed analysis about groups within minority groups. So because of the small population size, we might not get very robust or detailed information about groups within the trans community. So that speaks to the need for continued convenient sampling. So here we go, what to ask. The first measure I'd like to show you is what we call the two-step measure, and I'll show you a couple different versions of this. This method uses two questions to assess gender identity and sex assigned at birth. So when these two questions are cross-tabulated, they show those that show a sex assigned at birth that differs from their gender identity would be categorized as transgender. And those who do not have answers that differ across the two questions would not be categorized as transgender. So this approach was first developed in 1997 by the Transgender Health Advocacy Coalition, which was a community-based organization for use on a survey of trans people in Philadelphia. And then these measures were adapted by Jessica Xavier for the Washington Transgender Needs Assessment Survey of the Witness Study and the Virginia Transgender Health Information Study. And since 2007, the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health at the University of California at San Francisco has advocated for the use of this specific two-step question protocol in healthcare settings, and that's the version shown here. In 2011, the CDC added these items as data elements in the U.S. HIV/AIDS surveillance system, including the adult case report form as well as its electronic surveillance system. EHARS, the Enhanced HIV/AIDS Reporting System. And then other versions of this. So Sari and his colleagues evaluated this version of the two-step approach in a sub-study of a national sample of a longitudinal cohort study. So they conducted cognitive testing. It's very odd, actually, to be talking about this with Sari sitting right over there. in case I screw it up, maybe you can correct me later. But the cognitive testing interview participants, both cisgender and transgender, found that the items were easy to understand and the response options were acceptable in both questions. Importantly, this study validated the self-reported assigned sex at birth measure with the birth sex that was reported by the participants' mothers in an earlier questionnaire in the longitudinal study. So people who are reporting, self-reporting sex assigned at birth actually matched what their mothers reported at a very young age. So that was, that found complete agreement between those two, and that's great. it's very good to know that people are answering that question correctly. Quantitative analyses also provided evidence in support of the construct validity of the measure because when participants recalled from childhood and also reported their current gender nonconformity, so gender conformity that they were called in childhood and gender conformity now, gender nonconformity was higher among those classified as transgender as compared to those who are cisgender. So that speaks to the construct validity. And if I didn't explain that well, we can, maybe Sari can explain better later. Given that the sample was somewhat homogenous on race and ethnicity and educational attainment, it was a predominantly white, well-educated young adult sample, and also a sample that was accustomed to completing surveys as participants in a longitudinal cohort study. Sari and his colleagues recommended additional testing with diverse samples. So moving on to the final version of this question, so Amelia Lombardi and her colleagues evaluated this two-step approach in a predominantly white Midwestern adult sample using this specific version, so just the slight changes. Cognitive testing interview participants, both cisgender and transgender, recruited from Cleveland and Akron, Ohio, found the assigned sex at birth item was easy to answer, and no respondent selected unknown or declined to state response options, which is a good sign. Transgender respondents generally answered the sex or gender question on the basis of their gender identity, but several transgender respondents opted to use the other write-in option, four of which did so in addition to identifying as male or female. So they identified as male or female and then added some more information. This other category was used by them in addition to say that they were also transgender. So this suggests that the current question configuration would require additional resources and expertise to code the qualitative responses if qualitative responses are allowed. So an analyst needs to know what to do with that data. Some cisgender respondents viewed the question pair as redundant. They're like, how are these two things different? I don't understand. But it did not lead to a non-response, which is great. Cisgender respondents answered both sets of items as expected. So moving on to another a one-step measure, this is a question that was is used in the Massachusetts Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System Survey, first used in 2007. The question that appears here is the 2013 version. And the purpose is that it's a national collaborative health surveillance effort between the CDC and state departments of public health. Massachusetts chose to put this, Massachusetts again, and decided to add this question voluntarily to their survey. So Sari and his colleagues also cognitively tested this measure in the sample described earlier and found that the item was easily understood and answered by cisgender and most transgender participants. However, two of the nine trans participants did not answer affirmatively, did not answer with a yes response. So it's possible that this item may under-identify some transgender respondents. So further evaluation of sensitivity and specificity in a diverse representative sample is warranted based on that finding. I see I'm running out of time, so I will quickly go through the next two measures. So in regard to gender expression, a brief two-item survey measure was developed to assess gender conformity and nonconformity, referred to as socially assigned gender expression, because the respondents asked to report on his or her perception of how others perceive his or her gender presentation among adolescents and adults. So basically, what do you think others think of you? So Amelia Lombardi and her colleagues tested these items in the same sample described earlier for them and found that both cisgender and transgender folks had difficulty formulating responses to these questions due to variability in their gender expression over time and concerns about how different groups of people like, are you talking about how coworkers see me, how family members see me, or how, like, friends see me, how these people could vary in their perceptions of the respondent. So I think perhaps some additional testing is warranted, but this is a promising measure. And finally, the last measure I'll mention is a combined sexual orientation and gender identity question, which is somewhat controversial because those two concepts are combined in this one measure, and perhaps those two are being conflated. But the item successfully prevented false positives from cisgender respondents. So this question helped minimize that confusion that we were talking about earlier, because testing revealed that when more familiar terms like gay and lesbian preceded the transgender identity option, that deterred cisgender people and from inaccurately selecting the transgender option, because they figure, well, if this is part of a grouping, I know I don't belong in this particular grouping. So when only one item is allowed for sexual orientation or gender identity, this might be a potential option to go with. I have a lot of other things to say, but we can talk about all that later in the Q&A. All right, thank you very much.